For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, so tonight is tonight we're going to talk about happiness. As somebody pointed out, you know, you look at the crowd is much smaller. Like, nobody wants to talk about happiness. Happiness is a good thing. Everybody wants to talk about controversies and difficulties, like that stuff that everybody wants to know about. Like, happiness, whatever, whatever. So meanwhile, it's not that way. The pursuit of happiness. What is the Jewish approach? What's the Jewish understanding to this concept of happiness? Joy. It's without question that it is a tremendous focus in the Western world, Western society that we live in, this idea of a goal, a pursuit of happiness. It is something that is on our minds. It's something that we are concerned for. It's something that we want to achieve. And those, you know, looking back over 40, 50 years, one would say, if you could have looked back 40 years ago and told the generation of the 40s, 50s, 60s and said, do you know what life will be like in the year 2015? Do you know that we'll have smartphones? You'll be able to walk around with a computer in your hand, and microwaves will be the least of the interesting things. That's like so old, no one's even going to care about the concept of a microwave. But we'll have the type of technology that will make our lives so much easier, so much more convenient. And we would rattle off all of the things that for us are literally, you know, a given of the way that we live our life. I mean, you have cable television with 436 channels. 436 is amazing. And that's the cheap package. If you really pay money, you'll get 879. So that generation would say, well, for sure, that would be a generation that would be much more inclined to be a happier generation because they have it so good. And they have so many conveniences and so much luxury that for sure, and we all know living in the year 2015 that there couldn't be anything farther from the truth. That the greater technological advances we have, it seems to just push us farther and farther away from a life of happiness. And it does not, it did not create the luxury in life, the luxurious type of life, the calm. We now have things so easy. I don't have to cook for 16 hours. I have a microwave. It did not make our life any better. And it certainly did not bring happiness. And if buying the gadget for the first time gave you a moment of happiness or an hour of happiness within a day or two or a week, for sure it didn't do anything. So it's an interesting concept. And the whole concept of happiness, when you think about an animal, so if there's an animal out there in the world that's well-fed and rested and safe and warm, that animal will be pretty content. But we humans have this phenomenal capacity of being well-fed, comfortable, warm, and sheltered, completely miserable. It's a very human trait to say that all of your basic needs are met and yet be miserable. And we all know what that's like. None of us naturally say, like, oh, I know I have, I don't need anything else in life other than to know where my meal is coming from and a roof over my house. There's this drive, there's something that gnaws at us from deep within that says, I need more, I want more, and we would be very discontent if we don't have what that is. And this pursuit of something, which we can certainly call happiness on some level, is something that needs to be understood. So what's the Jewish view on this? What is the Jewish approach, the Torah's approach to this concept? So number one, if you want to just follow the notes along as I'll be talking, are we meant to be happy? Is it a Jewish view? If somebody would stop you, the great way that I like to quote Rabbi David Foreman, you know, sitting on an airplane and someone would turn to you and say, oh, you're Jewish. Do Jews believe you're supposed to be happy? Right? Well, how would you? Well, that's a tough one. What's the answer to that question? I see Rev. People have like, what to say on it? I'm sure you have what to say for a line. Anyone? Quick one word answers? Yes? No? Mitzvah gedolah liyos b'simcha. Anybody know where that source comes from? Is it in the Torah? Mitzvah gedola lihios besimcha. It's a song many of you have sung it, I'm sure, at wedding. Mitzvah gedola lihios besimcha toham. It's a great mitzvah to be joyous always. Does that come from the Torah? Any hands? Does the Facebook? Does it come from a Mishnah? No. Does it come from a Gemara? No. Does it come from the Talmud? No. Does it come from our earliest Rishonim, our earliest medieval commentators? No. It is believed to be traced back, I think it's a Rabbi Nachman from Breslov, which is a Hasidic statement. Okay, so the Hasidim believe, and they do believe that. But that does not mean that traces itself all the way back to the Torah. Which is interesting that that is in the 1700s we have that statement, but that's not something that we have always said. So is it a Jewish belief that it is our goal to be happy? In America, is it the goal to be happy? What do you think? I think so. So as a Jew living in America, if someone were to turn to you on a flight and say, oh, you're Jewish, do you believe it's your goal in life to be happy? So all of you, most of you I see right away said no. I'm not sure if that's born out of your Jewish experiences or your actual Jewish belief. Yeah. We're supposed to do mitzvahs with simcha. So that's an idea we're going to talk about, that where one has to do a mitzvah with joy. But if I ask you the question, are you supposed to be happy? So that's a different question, yeah.
Are we supposed to make our children happy?
No, who told you that? I teach your son every day in high school to make their parents miserable, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure why you would think that it's your job to make them happy. How am I doing, by the way? All right, we'll talk about that later. The next parent teachers conference. Yeah. Okay, excellent. So Dina points out that in the next world, we'll be happy, we'll be filled with a spiritual bliss. Excellent. Should I imply from your words that if you were to answer that question in this world, the answer is no, it's not my job to be happy. It's not my goal, it's not part of my mindset, it's not something I'm working towards, because that's not my job here.
I thought
happiness comes from doing the will of God, which is similar to happiness coming from doing a mitzvah, which we will for sure touch on that same concept as well. A groom should be happy with his bride, 100%. 100%. Okay, I'm sure there is, in terms of the difference between happy and joy. There are different words in the Chumash. Every word, of course, has different meanings. We have simcha, we have sason, we have gila. There are a lot of different words which have different connotations of joy. And there is what the linguists amongst our scholars talk about, the different reasons and meanings behind them. Whenever you have a different word in the Chumash, it clearly must mean something else. So if you have sason and simcha and gila, rina, there are different words which have elements of joy in them. So they're definitely a difference. Okay, last one, really last one, then I'm move on.
But there's, in Pirkei Avos, we have that who is happy, he who is satisfied with his lot.
Okay, good. That's not what the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says. What does the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says? Let's get it straight first. What does the Mishnah say? No. But what is it answering? What's the question the Mishnah asks? Who is rich? Who is rich? He who is happy with what he has will be considered rich. But the Mishnah is not asking who's considered happy. Okay, is it possible to achieve happiness? And I'm just going on some questions that should really just food for thought. Is it possible to be happy in a sad world? I mean, there's a lot of sadness around us. I don't need to describe that to you. There's a lot of sadness. Is it possible to be happy? What about if I know so many people who are suffering, can I be happy when I'm in their presence and I know what they're going through? So am I allowed to? Can I be happy without being insensitive to them, without forgetting about them and putting them out of sight, out of mind? Or what about the person who themselves is suffering? Are they supposed to be happy through their suffering, or is happiness for others who have to can look at others? But if I'm suffering yourself, these are again, we live and have grown up in America where there's this inalienable right of the pursuit of happiness. There are some serious questions that need to be asked about whether or not this is a Jewish value, pursuing happiness in the face of real life suffering, tragedy that surrounds us, that we live with. Is that indeed our goal, to achieve happiness? And if we did indeed achieve it, can we sit back and say, I made it. I'm happy. I'm actually happy. And maybe that's a good thing, but is that really our goal? Okay, so let's begin our discussion. Is it a mitzvah to be happy? Is it one of the 613 mitzvahs? Be happy. We can make a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you, O God, who has commanded me in the mitzvah of happiness. Yes or no? No, you will not find one of the 613 mitzvahs to be happy. We do have an element on Sukkos to be happy, v'samachta b'chagecha, and all yontiv, one must rejoice in the holiday, which is manifested by specific behaviors of eating meat, drinking wine, buying nice clothes, new outfit before the yontiv. So there's an element of rejoicing in the holiday. But just as one of the 613, just to say, yes, a Jew is commanded to be happy, no, we do not find such a mitzvah. There is no mitzvah amongst the 613 to be happy. Yet, the Samachta B'chagecha is in the Torah, yes. That is actually in the Torah, correct. There are many statements, both from the Torah, the sages, and beyond, that certainly extol the virtues of joy. That's certainly there. Some of you already mentioned some of them. Just to bring two of the classics, it's on your letter number C. Serve Hashem with joy, come before Him with gladness. In Hebrew, it's something you're familiar with from our daily davening. Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, bo'u lefanav birnana. Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha. Serve Hashem with joy, come before Him with gladness. We have a very pile. Where does it come from? It's from the Psalms, from Tehillim. David HaMelech teaches us, you must serve God with joy and come before Him with gladness. We have another pasuk back already in the Chumash in Sefer Devarim. The end of Sefer Devarim, there is what's known as the Tochacha, the admonition, the curses that will befall the Jewish people if they don't listen to the laws of the Torah. It's a 98 verse long series of really horrific descriptions. It almost like foreshadows word for word what we saw in the Holocaust 60, 70 years ago. And in the midst of that, the Torah throws in a phrase, and you know why this is going to happen to you? Do you know why you're going to fall before all these horrible things will befall you and you'll suffer terribly? Tachas asher lo avadato es Hashem besimcha uvitov levav. Because you did not serve Hashem with joy and with goodness of heart. Because you did not serve with joy, this is what's going to happen. Very strong statement, considering that it's not an actual mitzvah to be filled with joy. That if you don't serve with joy, if du as Hashem b'simcha serva, if you don't, like everything will fall apart. Very, very strong statements. But we have this idea of you should be serving with joy. We have a statement from the sages that the Shechina is Eina Shruya, the divine presence only rests on a Jew who is in the midst of a sense of joy associated with mitzvahs, as has been brought up. One has to do mitzvahs with joy. And if a Jew is not doing mitzvahs with his, if he's not enveloped with the joy that comes from doing mitzvahs, so then he could not possibly have a prophecy, he could not be enveloped with the divine presence that only rests upon somebody who's filled with joy. Indeed, one other statement, just to set the table with some of the things that we have to address. There's a statement from the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, who lived in the late 1800s up to the 1953. He was the leading sage in the land of Israel during that time period. A Gadol Hador, the leader of the generation. And he writes in one of his letters what would seem to be at face value and just an impossible statement to understand. And he writes that for one who knows the light of truth, there is no sadness in the world. One who knows the light of truth, there is no sadness. Very perplexing statement. I mean, there's a lot of sadness in the world. There's a lot of sadness. We know, we've experienced. But if you know the light of truth, he writes, there is no such thing as sadness. So where does this all fit? This idea that there is no sadness, this idea that you must serve with sadness. How does that fit with this idea? What are we commanded to do? What is our goal? What is our striving when it comes to this concept of happiness? So let's start with a little bit of what happiness is not. Let's start with a few things that we could at least peel away a couple of layers and say, okay, we know that it's for sure not this. First thing that I would say that happiness is not is, by definition, anything outside of you that will not bring you happiness. Meaning to say, if you have the experience of listening to any advertisement, be it on the radio, be it on television, you'll hear one theme over and over and over again. And that theme goes something like this. You need this. Not just you need this, you deserve this. And because you deserve this, when you get this, then you'll be happy. Because there is no joy like the joy of holding a can of Coke in your hand. That's the best, right? There's nothing like that. So there's the entire world around us screams to us, literally every time you turn on the radio in the car, every time you see any commercial on television, it's screaming one message to you, and one message only, because that's why they're advertising, because they want something from you, and that is your money. And the way they're going to get your money is by telling you, you need whatever it is that they're selling. But there's a message there that's being played over in our head over and over and over again, and that is, you need something out there to fulfill yourself, to make yourself whole, to make yourself happy. And if only you would have that, then you'll be great. And as soon as you are looking outside to bring something in, that's not where happiness comes from. Happiness, from a Jewish perspective, is very counterintuitive to the culture we live. Happiness is taking what you have and sharing it on the outside, with the outside. It's very counterintuitive, because we grow up in a world and a culture that says, you know, it's the give me, gather more, accumulate more, the more I have, the bigger I am, the better I am, the stronger I am. So it's an accumulation type society. And what Judaism has always taught is that true osher, true happiness and true wealth comes from taking whatever you have and sharing it with everybody around you. And if you'll experiment, I challenge all of you to do so. In fact, I know I don't have to challenge you, because you've all already experienced this many times in your life. The different feelings between taking from the outside in versus taking from the inside and giving it out. And there's something immensely fulfilling about taking what you have and giving it to somebody else. Say, how could that make you happy? It goes against everything that the commercials told me. It's true, it is. It's exactly right. And that's where the happiness comes from the ability to give. And that's because, referencing many things we've spoken about many, many times, true godliness is that which is intrinsic from within, and then sharing it with those on the outside. And every time that we do that, we're literally acting in a godly way, and there's nothing more fulfilling or satisfying than that. So when we talk about happiness, we can talk more about this, but we've already spoken about this many times in the past. If you're looking for happiness out there, so you're likely not going to find it. And it's a very counterintuitive concept of taking from within and giving it out. That's just step one, just as an opening line. I want to share something else. I was at a funeral, Friday. Many of you might actually know the Nifteres, so the woman who passed away, was a woman in her 60s who was a special needs individual, who had lived her life, almost her entire life, in a home for special needs children and then later adults, and had the mental capacity, according to her family, which I learned at the funeral, of a 10-year-old child. That was her mental capacity. Lived her life with a tremendous amount of joy, with a smile on her face. She was friendly, loved to greet people. People really spoke, her family and friends spoke glowingly about her at the funeral, which was indeed a very sad funeral for me. There was one comment that was made by a family member which really struck a chord with me. And I'll share it with you. One family member said that the woman, it was a sister, it was not one of the siblings, it was a different family member, said that this individual who passed away lived with great joy, with a tremendous smile, extremely happy, because her life was so simple. She didn't have to worry about the things that grown-ups generally have to worry about. She didn't have to worry about paying her bills. She didn't have to worry about what her friends will think of her. She didn't have to worry what she would do as a career, whether or not she was fulfilling anything. She didn't have to worry about those things. She literally woke up every morning with the purity, the simplicity of a 10-year-old, and lived with that joy in a way that life was meant to be. That was the statement. Came home Friday night, and I sat in my Shabbos with my children, and I said, do you agree with the following statement? That life is meant to be simple, without having to worry about decisions, without having to make difficult decisions, without having to worry about anything, that it should just be simple, straightforward. Do you agree or disagree with that statement? Yeah? So we can take a route of being boring. I think on a simple level, basing ourselves on some of the other classes we've had just in the most recent weeks, that's not why we're here, that it should be simple. It should be a challenge. It should be complex. Life is complex. And it doesn't mean, I'll get to you in a second, it doesn't mean you can't have a smile on your face, but if the smile is coming because you have nothing to worry about, I don't know that I would say that's the way life was supposed to be. Yeah?
The American dream is to retire and have no worries.
Right.
That's not the Jewish concept at all, you know.
Very good. Bringing it back into in the American world we live in, like that's what we're all working towards, being on the beach, sipping a pina colada in my hammock. So like that seems like the way life should be. And our Tanakh teaches us, Adam la'omel yulad, man was created to toil, man was created to work, man was created to struggle. And that doesn't mean you can't struggle with a smile, but it doesn't mean that the simplicity is the goal. Which is an interesting lead into the next thing we're going
to
talk about, yeah? I don't know. My children said no. They did not agree with that statement. They think, God, I've heard enough things from me. They're like, for sure, if you're asking us this question, there's no way the answer is to agree. They didn't know why the answer was disagree, but they knew that if the question made its way to the table, the answer was disagree. That much they knew. I was speaking with somebody this morning or something about, and he started a new venture, yesterday maybe it was, a new business, and I said, how are things going? And he said, well, I got a couple of, things up in the air, and I got a risk coming over here, and this and the other. And I said, well, I hope all, works out into place and everything should be well. And he responded to whatever it was that I had said to him with, I had heard from my mentor that if you're not worried about your investments, you're not taking enough risk. That's a sign in the world of business. Like if you have no worries whatsoever, then you're not going to accomplish very much. Because if there's no risk, then there's no upside. That's just the way that things go. So if you're not worried at all about anything, then you're not doing anything. You got your money in the bank. So if that's okay with you, great. But if you want to invest, then there's got to be some risk by definition. Yeah.
But if you live simpler, you don't have so many possessions and things like that that bog you down.
So, excellent. So what does simple mean? Does simple mean I have nothing to worry about in terms of decisions of who I'm going to be, what I'm going to do, or simple like I don't have a lot of possessions? So there's certainly an element of, as the Mishnah says, mar bedvarim, mar bedaig. The Mishnah Perkei Avos says the more things a person has, the more worry a person has. And from that perspective, yes, simplicity of I have what I need and I don't need all these things, I have less to worry about with less stuff. That's for sure. But the sentiment of that there are no decisions to make in life, and that brings me happiness as the goal in life, that because I have no decisions to make, in that sense of simplicity, like I have no choices. There's no, and that's why I could be so happy. That's not an ideal, as far as we have lots of decisions to make all the time, and our decisions matter. And this brings us into the bulk of what we'll talk about. So then, what is the Jewish view on happiness? I'd like to quote you from Rabbi Akiva Tatz. Rabbi Akiva Tatz has a book called The Jewish Teenager's Guide to Life, which is a catchy title. It has nothing to do with teenagers, but it has everything to do with A Nice Guide to Life. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. And if you think I'll make you feel like a teenager again, go right ahead. You can read it also. But it really, I found it far more sophisticated than most of the teenagers I know are ready for. But that's what he titled it. Excellent book. He has an entire chapter there on happiness. And I want to share a few from some of his thoughts, which I've seen expressed in several other places as well. Here's his one-line definition. Letter E. Real happiness is what you experience when you are doing what you should be doing. Real happiness. Very sort of broad, and we'll talk a lot about this. Real happiness comes from doing is the experience you get when you are doing what you should be doing. And he explains in the box. When you're moving clearly along your own road, your unique path to your unique destination, when you're traveling and you're doing the things that you need to do to fulfill who you are and who you need to become, then you experience real happiness. When you are moving along the path that leads to yourself, to the deep discovery of who you really are, when you are building the essence of your own personality and creating yourself, a deep happiness wells up within you. The journey does not cause the happiness. The journey is the happiness itself. Now, there are a couple of important points of which we'll spend a few minutes discussing. He has this concept here of a journey towards self-discovery, becoming who you are, who you have the potential to become. We've mentioned many times in previous classes when we've talked about suffering, when we've talked about tragedies, that there's a certain quality, something's brought out from within us, which is only brought out through trial. In other words, when things are great and you're sitting back in the hammock, I don't know what I can accomplish because I'm not forced into really trying to figure that out. And then when certain situations, like, how are you holding up? I don't have a choice. I have to. I didn't know that I could do this before. But now I see that this is who I am. That experience of becoming the person who I can, taking a child who is still young in elementary school, and then as they mature and as they grow through life, they themselves develop into the person that they become. How does that happen? Through all of their life experiences. As that happens, that journey is the becoming of the person themselves. That journey is happiness. Now, we're going to continue discussing this. The look on the face of such a person, let's take a simple example. I've used this example before, but I'm going to use it again now. It's his example, Rabbi Akiva Tatz's, and I think it's really the simplest, effective example. Person wants to become a bodybuilder. That's my goal. I want to be a bodybuilder, I want to lose weight. Whatever the two, let's say the two go together. So how do you do that? How do you do that? That's my goal. Well, it takes a lot of exercise. Takes a lot of changing of the diet, and then you gotta start lifting weights, like serious, serious weights. Are any of those things easy? None of those things are easy. It's not easy to change a diet. I think we all know that. Whatever it is that we normally do, whatever that is, changing that is hard. Exercise, goes without saying, it is hard to get ourselves to do it. And then to do serious weight, not just exercise like jogging around there, and I mean serious weights. That's what I want. I really want to be in shape. Really hard. Painfully hard. The way that Rabbi Akiva Tatz used the example, and I'm sure that I've said this in this forum before, if you were to take somebody from another universe, and you'd bring him down to this wonderful planet that we have here called planet Earth, and this wonderful country that we have here called the United States of America, and you'd bring him to a wonderful organization where they charge you to lift weights. You pay the membership, and they let you in the door. And then he would look through a little peephole in the door, and he would see, he'd see a person there, and he's straining every muscle in his body, and sweat is pouring off of his face, and every vein is bulging out of his body, and his body is tremoring with the physical exertion of every single thing that he had. And he would say, like, whoa, what kind of torture chamber is this? Who is the person who's got some weapon trained on him that's standing in the background that I can't see? And you would say, there's nobody there. You say, no way, look at what he's going through. The little man looks like he's going to die. You say, God, he's paying money for this. Not only is he paying money, but he's paying extra because he hired a personal trainer who's standing behind him, who's pushing him, saying, more! Do it. And he's paying him to be his personal trainer to push him. Say, that's insane. So it's not insane. We know what's going on. You want that which you want to accomplish. So no pain, no gain. It's not a made up. That's a real thing. So you say, what's the look on the face of the bodybuilder? What's his look? Pain, exertion, to the point of collapse. He's putting everything he's got in there. Is there a smile on his face? No. Definitely not. What's his feeling that's going on inside? It's total happiness. Because he knows, I have a goal, and every muscle that I feel ripping inside my body, every cell that rips will grow back stronger than the one that I just ripped by straining myself to lift that weight. And literally that's how it works. The muscle fibers rip and grow back stronger. So you, and if I don't feel a rip, then I'm not doing anything. I know physiologically, if there's no rip in my arm, if I don't feel the pain, I'm not accomplishing anything. And since I want to accomplish, I have to feel the pain to push myself forward. So the look on the face of the person experiencing this is not joy at all. There's no joy on the look of the face. But deep inside, there is, without question, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of a drive of moving towards something. And it's the pain itself which is that source of the joy. Work and gain is always achieved only through resistance. If there's no resistance, you don't achieve anything. It's a fact in life. There must be resistance that you're forcing yourself against to achieve something. And that gives you that sense of moving ahead. The depth of the pleasure that you will receive is the anticipation of the results that you want to get. If you don't care about looking a certain way after having lifted weights, I'm not interested in that. So, well then, why are you doing this? He's like, I don't know, someone told me that I have to. But I have no interest in that. No interest. How much joy do you have in the pain then? I'm not interested in that goal. It's not that I enjoy pain. It's that I want the result. When I want the results, then the pain is what takes me there. If I don't want the results, then it's actually torture. But if I want the results, then that pain is not less painful, it's more pleasurable. Again, not in the moment, it's still pain, but this is working towards my goal. The more one looks forward to the joy of the end point, the more one enjoys the labor of getting there. Think about that in your work lives, in every aspect of your life. If there's an end point that you look forward to, the pain of getting there is actually part of the process. But if I don't, then it's not. And what happens as you put forth all that effort, all that exertion, all that pain? You are literally creating yourself through that. This is me making myself as I go through this process, learning from each mistake, going through the experience, fixing it, developing, so that when I look at the finished product, in a very real sense, what I actually see is me. This is me. I just made myself. Can you still hear me? I know I'm out. Let me just see. Their battery died. Ugh. But we'll go without it.
We'll go without it.
So the sense that you feel that you've actually made and created yourself, the joy of building. We all know anytime you make something yourself, there's a certain satisfaction of having done this. I did this. Whether it's a 4-year-old coming home from preschool with a project, 14-year-old, 24, 44, 84, doesn't matter. When you make something, and you put your kishkas into it, and you look at it and you say, ah, you did it. This is mine. This is me. So then, the joy that comes from, there's a sense of deep, inner happiness that comes from being able to create that. Rabbi Abraham Twersky says over a story, I've seen it in a couple of his books. He happens to write in the introduction to his books that he wrote, I think he published 31 books, and I think he writes that I really wrote one book 31 different times, all about self-esteem and how to create self-esteem and live with self-esteem. And 31 different ways of writing the same book. So I've seen this a couple of different times in different books of his. He says as follows: there was once a Jew, it doesn't make a difference, in Tsarist Russia, sometime in the whatever it was, who was arrested for whatever it was that he did. And his punishment was 25 years of hard labor. And the nature of his hard labor was he was chained to a wall. And while he was chained to a wall, he had to like spin this wheel, this huge, heavy, like sort of windmill kind of wall that was attached to the wall. And for 25 years, he just had to just back-breaking labor spinning this wheel. And he starts off his term, and it's just back-breaking. And at some point, he has a thought. He says, "You know what? I bet on the other side of this wall." This is creating the energy that's needed for some type of electricity or some type of power, and this is producing something or another, and that the way that the country is set up is they have all of the slave laborers like me are providing all of this energy for the country in various different places, and that thought kept him going for 25 years. And as he nears the end of the 25 years, all he's thinking is, I can't wait to find out what I've done, what I've been doing, what this is set up to. And the last day finally comes, and after 25 years, they release the shackles, and the first thing that he does is he runs to the other side of the wall to see, and what does he find? Nothing. It's not hooked up to anything. He was just for 25 years spinning the wheel, and he drops dead on the spot. That's the story that Twersky tells to illustrate what it's like to toil for no purpose. What it's like to toil when you don't see a goal at the end of what it is that you're doing. That is torture. If there's a goal, then it's purposeful. And not only is it purposeful, it's fulfilling. It's the difference between exercising because someone is making you, you would say it's torture, versus I want to look a certain way, so I'll pay money for it. It's the same work. But what's the difference in your attitude towards it is only what it is that you see at the end. If there's nothing moving towards the end, if it's not going anywhere, it is a definition of torture. The sages say the Jews in Egypt, to Paro, were forced to build on land that could not sustain the buildings so that they would work and work and work and the buildings would collapse. And that was the definition of avodas parach. That's backbreaking, torturous work where you don't see a point. But a laborer who's building a pyramid on his own and would do the same labor, except when he finishes, he stands back and he says, look what I did. What's he filled with? Total joy of accomplishment. They do the same thing, except one's pyramid collapsed and he gets nothing, and one creates a wonder of the world. The difference is where you're going with your labor. And if you're going somewhere with your labor, then the labor becomes literally a labor of love. Because you're putting yourself into it, and you're creating yourself through that labor. The idea that when we toil in something, that we make ourselves, we shape ourselves through the ordeals that we have in life. Through we literally become different types of people. That's why whenever you try to find happiness on the outside and bring it in, it doesn't compare to the happiness that comes when you yourself toil or work on something. Because let's say you buy a nice fancy car. You don't become the car. You just have a car. And because you didn't fundamentally change who you are, you didn't develop, you didn't mature, you didn't refine yourself, you didn't become something new, you just got something new. It doesn't last. It doesn't have any deep meaning. It doesn't have any existential experience. I have more stuff. But when I go through something and I'm changed in the process, then I'm a fundamentally different person. I have to share. My Rosh Hashiva, Reb Chaim Yaakov Goldover from Keren Biavna, used to start every Pesach with the following story. I've for sure told the story Pesach time before, but I'm going to tell it again because it fits. He would tell the story of two brothers, two poor brothers. And these two brothers had nothing, used to scrounge around in the garbage for little bits and scraps of food to eat. And they would dream at night in the little shack. They would dream at night about changing their lives, their life's fortune. And one day while they're scrounging through the garbage for some food, they come across a lottery ticket that somebody had bought and they dropped. The drawing was the following night. And so they're lying in bed in their little shack and the two of them say, "What would you do if we won the lottery?" And one brother, Brother A, says, "Oh, if I won the lottery, I would buy myself 3 houses. I'd have my place in Florida, in Miami, in California, in New York. I'd go see every show. I'd buy a football team. I'd have a yacht. I'd eat in every restaurant around the world. I would have everything that I wanted." His brother says, "Okay, that's nice. If I won the lottery," says Brother B, "I always wanted to be a doctor. I would go back to school. I never had a chance to have an education. Never had a chance to learn in university. I would hire tutors. I would catch up on all my studies. I would get myself into the best university. And I would become a doctor." And Brother A looks at him and says, "Okay, man, if that's what you want, more power to you. But I hope we win." And sure enough, as all good stories go, they win. They win the lottery. Each brother gets a share of the pot. $15 million each brother. That's a small lottery. $150 million per brother. And each one does as he said he was going to do. Brother A buys himself fancy clothing, fancy houses. He buys himself yacht. He travels the world. He eats at every restaurant in the world. He's having a blast. And Brother B hires himself some tutors. He catches up on his studies, gets himself into a fine university, has all the finest tutors there, continues his learning, gets himself into medical school. And every year the brothers, on the day of the anniversary that they won the lottery, would get together in their little shack and they'd put on their old clothing and they would remember what it was like when they were poor, that they should appreciate what it is that they have. And every year that would happen, from wherever in the world the two brothers were, they'd get together in the shack, they'd put on their old clothing, and they would talk about what it was like back in the day when they had nothing. As all good stories go, good old friend of theirs has a good investment for them, tells them that if they put all their money in, they'll quadruple everything that they had, they go all in, the deal goes bust, they end up with nothing. Back to where they started. Zero. A few months later, the anniversary of the day they won the lottery rolls around. Brother B doesn't have to change his clothing. That's all he's got now. And he shows up in their old shack to celebrate the day that they won the lottery. And he's waiting for Brother A to show up, and Brother A doesn't come. Waiting, doesn't come. He goes out to find him, finds him in some other shack in some other part of town, and he says, "Today's the day. Today's our anniversary. You didn't show up. We've been showing up for the last 5, 6, 7 years. This is the day we get together." Brother Ray looks at him and says, "Are you nuts? Are you out of your mind? I don't have anything. The yacht's gone. The houses are gone. The football team is gone. I haven't been traveling the world. I don't have anything. I should get together and talk about the day that we won the lottery and remember what it was like. I have nothing." And Brother B says to him, "Ah, my dear brother, you're right. I understand. You don't have anything. It doesn't make sense for you to celebrate the day that we won the lottery. But I'm a doctor. I took my money and I changed who I am fundamentally. I learned, I studied, I grew. You can't take that away from me. I have no money now, but I have the tools to get a job. I have the skill set to become something, to be a someone. You can't take my education away from me. So I'm going to celebrate the day we won the lottery, even though now I don't have a cent to my name, but I'm a different person." The Rosh Hashiva used to say that every year Pesach, how do we as Jews celebrate our freedom while we're in exile? How do we celebrate? We're not free anymore. And he would say, yeah, if your freedom is measured by your houses and your cars and your yachts, so in exile, Jews aren't free. We can't do what it is that we need to do. But if you measure freedom by the spiritual freedom that we have, the ability to learn Torah, to keep mitzvahs, to have a relationship with Hashem, to daven, so we're fundamentally different people before Yetzias Mitzrayim and after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Fundamentally, we have an education, we have a spiritual education. You can't ever take that away from us as a Jewish people. That idea summarizes everything that we've said. If you measure happiness by what I have, so then the happiness can come, the happiness can go. It's not really going to make you happy. But if the process of getting from who I am now to what it is that I need to be, why I was created, if you go back to the class that we had, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago about free will and about becoming through our choices the human beings that we're capable of becoming, you can't take that away from us. That's part of the journey. Every decision we make, every victory that we have, every choice, every right word that comes out of our mouth, every time we stop ourselves from saying what we shouldn't say, we literally, it's part of our education. It's fundamentally changing who we are. And that's a journey. And it's a journey that when a person realizes that he's on, and that's why he's here, brings a tremendous sense of satisfaction. And here is the point that ties it all together. If we don't recognize that journey that we're on, then all the steps along the way, the trials, the tribulations, the difficulties, the sufferings, the ordeals that we have, they are torture. If you don't see it in a context of, this is taking me from point A to point B. And my job on earth is to get to point B. How am I going to get there? Every day is going to be a challenge. Every day is going to be an ordeal. Every day is going to be a fight. But there's no other way for me to create my muscles other than through strain and difficulty, trials. That's how it works. But I see that. I'm fundamentally shifting, not just gaining stuff. I'm becoming different. The same act of lifting weights, of building a pyramid, is transformed from torture to bringing me the inner joy, happiness of bringing me to the place that I am destined to be. That's why you will find the verses that we quoted in the beginning don't say, be happy. They say, serve Hashem with joy. Ivdu es Hashem besimcha. Serve with joy. To be happy is not our commandment. Our commandment is, do the right things with happiness. What's the right thing? Serving Hashem. In the same way, if you take it out of the spiritual realm, just talk about a person working through the corporate world. He wants to be a CEO. So every step along the way, every hour that he puts in, he sees the progress. There's great inner joy in that. In the spiritual realm, I have to become a person that's godly. That's my goal, that's my task. Every day of my life is working towards godliness. How do I achieve that? By handling all the crazy situations that God throws at me and tells me, handle that one godly, and that one, and handle that person with godliness, and that person too. And I see that this is what it's doing to me. It's changing me. And every difficulty which we should never know from them, and the pain and the sorrow and how we grow from them, and we shouldn't know from them. But what happens is the reality is that somehow we become different. And to see that as part of the process is the only part that takes it out of torture, out of this unanswerable question of why is God making me suffer, to I still don't have the answer to the question of why God's making me suffer. I don't know why. But I see that it's part of a process of getting me from point A to point B. And as I work through that, my face is tear-streaked. My face is showing duress and pain and suffering like a bodybuilder. But I know that I'm working towards something. And I don't have to understand what that is while I'm going through that pain. The bodybuilder doesn't have to know every time, like, oh, this is... So in life, it's hard. It's painful. But as we scale back, in moments when we can, when we're not in it, and we can see that all those difficulties are bringing us to something, is bringing us to a goal. I'm not going to talk about depression, not clinical depression with a chemical imbalance, but the idea that we all go through moments of depression, and when we go through not just moments, but days or weeks, we have this concept of depression. The one concept, if you look into this and you Google it, you look into all the psychological books, you'll find over and over and over and over again, hopelessness, meaningless. Life is I don't see myself going anywhere. I'm not moving towards something. I'm not becoming anything. Well, then, yeah, I understand that. If that person doesn't see that, then that which life throws our way, the pain, the difficulty, the suffering, is hopeless and meaningless, and it's just painful. It's just hurtful, not going anywhere. That's a great cause for depression. It's seeing a context of a soul being brought down to this world to achieve godliness, to achieve as much perfection as they can, learn, live, experience, grow, become godly, that allows us to deal with the difficulties and see them as part of a process. There are tools towards achieving this. There are tools. There's so much out there. If you go to like TED Talk and type in happiness, you'll find 1,000 different speeches on the keys to happiness. This is what you need to do for happiness. There are lots of things out there. From a Jewish perspective, again, is the goal. There's one line that I think I read through. Yes, I wanted to read this goal in on the top of your second page. Happiness is not the goal, but it is the assured result of moving towards the goal in life. Happiness is not the goal. Meaning, if a person on a plane turns to you and says, "Hey, you're Jewish. Do Jews believe that happiness is the goal in life?" The answer is no. My goal is not to be happy. My goal is to achieve as close to perfection and godliness in my life as I can. And I am guaranteed that if I am working towards that, I will be happy. Because I'm working towards something. I see my life in that context. That will bring me joy. My goal is not to achieve happiness. My goal is to achieve growth. And if I'm in a growth mode and I'm achieving growth, I will be happy. But that's not because my goal was to be happy. What are some of your tools towards that? I want to just share two. Number one is, we'll refer to it as Shabbos. But it's not really that Shabbos is the goal. But Shabbos' goal is follows. I saw this in a book written by Rebbetzin Tzipora Heller. She described that we often forget the difference between urgent and importance. Very important concept. Urgent and important. What are things that are urgent? Things that are urgent are things that must be done right now. Because if it's not done right now, it will not get done or will not be done in a way that's sufficient or in a way that can be the same way that it's done right now. Examples of things that are urgent. If you're making scrambled eggs and you don't flip the eggs at the time that they need to be flipped, what's going to happen to your scrambled eggs? So it's urgent that you're on top of your scrambled eggs. If you have a delicate wash on in your dryer, it's urgent that when the dryer buzzes, then you get in there and take everything out. Because if you don't, you're just going to have to do it again. It's going to get ruined. So this must be done right now. And we have other deadlines, some of which are important, some of which are less important. Is it really important? In the scheme of things, I think most people would say about those two examples, it's not important, but those are things that we live our life that's urgent, that must be done. What are things that are important? Important to come up with things, family time, whether it be career, whether it be spiritual growth, learning. There are lots of things that are important. What happens in life, in this little snippet is such a great way of thinking about things, is that we get lost on the things that are urgent, and don't have time for the things that are important. Because urgency takes I have to do this now. If I don't do this now, it won't get done. And so a day is filled, going from one deadline to another deadline, of things that are all bona fide, objectively urgent. But they're just not as important as the things that they're pushing off, because of their urgency. And Shabbos is a gift that we have amongst all the other aspects of the gift of Shabbos. There are no deadlines. I shouldn't say no, but there are very few deadlines. That 25-hour bliss is, if you think about all the deadlines we have in our regular daily routines, and the bliss of Shabbos is a chance to recalibrate and take care of the things that are actually important. Now, we can not pay attention to Shabbos and sleep the whole day away also. There's no question about that. I'm sure we're all very good at that. But it gives us a chance to focus on that which is important and not just that which is urgent. Make a list. Go through your day, go through your week. What are the things that are really important, and how many of them are not getting done because of all the things that are urgent that are taking up time? And the Shabbos is a gift, the blessing that we have is a chance to focus on it. That's a tool to being focused. Why is that a tool? Because happiness comes from moving in the right direction. Happiness comes from a Jew who feels, I'm growing, I'm developing, I'm on a path of doing what I should be doing. I feel like I'm moving in the right direction in life. Well, you can only feel like you're moving in the right direction if you take the time to make sure that you're doing the things that are important to you, not just the things that are urgent in your life. And if you take the time to make sure that you have that list of the things that are important, you will feel that happiness because you're doing the things. There's no greater frustration. I don't need to tell this to you because you all know this already, I'm sure, on your own. The deep frustration when another week goes by and all the things that you had in your head that were important didn't get done. And the reason why they didn't get done is because you had other things that had to get done. They had to get done. So the important things didn't. That is deep frustration. Enough of those deep frustrations leads to depression. Is a strong word, but that's where you're like, not depression, just like frustrated, sad. I don't feel like I'm going anywhere because every week I say the same things that I wanted to do, I didn't do. The happiness comes from these are the important things to me, and I'm doing them. I'm moving somewhere. Moving leads to happiness. Our goal is not to be happy. Our goal is to be moving. Our goal is to be growing. Our goal is to be changing. That will bring happiness. One last tool, and that is the appreciation, gratitude. Again, you've probably heard many, many lectures about this, but it's worth just sharing one more thing. We are hardwired. I'll close now with what I opened with. People don't come to a happiness class. Why? Controversy and disputes and conflict. That like grabs our attention. But like good things, when things are normal, very. Imagine either if you were coming home if you go back to your childhood years, or if you were your child or your grandchild, if you were a teacher, and you got the following report card in front of you. You got one A and three Bs and one F. And your immediate reaction is? I'm an F. What's the deal? We are hardwired to react that way. And that's not the most healthy way, because all that we're doing is focusing on what went wrong. The A. Do you know how much effort went into getting that A? Do you know how many hours of studying the child put in to get that A? How many hours went into the three Bs? How tough, difficult those subjects are for him? And he really should have gotten a C, but he earned the B, and he got one F. And all the child hears is, how do we fix this F? That's what we notice. You know, flip on the news. Nobody ever opened up a news story with, you know, everything was great today. It was really nice. Weather was nice. People were nice in the streets. Nobody hurt anybody. And the Braves won. Great day. You never hear news. It's not interesting to us. We're interested in stimulation. Stimulation comes from something out of the ordinary. Sometimes out of the ordinary positively. Most of the time what stimulates us is out of the ordinary negatively. And we're always looking for stimulation. Always, always, always. Because Adam la'omel yulad. Man was created to toil. Man was created to work. Man was created to struggle. So we're looking for stimulation. We will naturally find that stimulation on the things that are out of the ordinary in a negative way. We're drawn to it. We always look for that kind of story. That story will always draw more attention than everything is good. Boring. And we have to look for the bright spots. To appreciate them. You have to recognize them. If your stimulation is always coming from negative sources, it's not a happy, joyous life, because your stimulation is coming from negative places. We're looking for stimulation. We always want to be stimulated. So you could be stimulated by growth. You could be stimulated by the excitement of developing as a person, of changing, of learning. I'm learning new things every day. I have my chavrusa, I'm learning in Torah, I'm learning in secular, I'm learning, I'm just being stimulated. Or I'll be stimulated by, attracted to, drawn to things that stimulate me because they're negative. We're drawn to that. But a person who's focused on finding the positive, even though it's boring, but I find the positive in my life. And I stimulate myself in a positive way, Those are tools that we have to feel like we're growth-oriented, that we're moving somewhere. There's a goal here in life that I'm trying to achieve. And when I feel like I'm moving towards that goal, I feel like I'm going somewhere, that creates the deep-seated happiness from within us. So I conclude again with, when the person on the plane turns to you and says, do Jews believe it's your goal to be happy? The answer, I believe, is no. It's not your goal to be happy. Even though in America we live where the pursuit of happiness is an inalienable right to pursue happiness, we don't pursue happiness. We pursue growth. We pursue change. We pursue godliness. And guaranteed, if you pursue growth and godliness through the challenges that we have, sometimes it's through tears and toiling and emotional difficult things, 100%. But if you pursue growth and change and godliness, you will accomplish happiness. Have yourselves a wonderful... And then we have one last class. Next week is the final class. Final class. It occurred to me that Shavuos, which is 2 weeks from tonight, second day of Shavuos, is a Monday night. It's a Monday night. So by a show of hands, I'm thinking this is just, if there's interest, would there be interest in a Monday afternoon final essentials type class? It's the second day of Yom Tov, so it's not so simple. Or we could just end it next week. Will be our final. Next week is our final scheduled week. There will be classes on Monday afternoon. It just wouldn't be like this kind of format. So everyone's done. It's like been a long class. Some yes. I have a class on Monday night of the second day of Shavuos, Monday afternoon before the end of Yom Tov. So we'll see. We'll throw some. We'll see how what we'll do with that. But certainly next week is our last formal official class, and we'll see you all then. Have a great evening.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.